Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with Plush Care. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So hey everybody, welcome to episode 47 of the More Than Just Go podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined once again by my co-host Aaron Bay in Whitby, Ontario.
Hello there.
And we have Mark Rubin down in San Jose, I believe.
Hi there. I am in San Jose.
Yeah. Can I just give a quick shout out to Mark Thistle, a fellow who wrote me last week after our show, and he said he's checked out Magpie. It looks very interesting. Thank you very much. But he noticed that my website did not have a smart app banner. And it's a feature that Apple introduced in iOS 6 to accompany websites that are visible on iOS Safari. And if you visit an app page, you can, as the web developer, put in a little meta tag. And if you do that, it'll show a little banner. I'm sure you've seen it. Showing you a direct link to the app store so you can get the app from the site in one tap. So that was a simple matter of fixing it, and I thank you to Mark for pointing it out, reminding me. I've done it before in other apps, just overlooked it this time. So, you know, when I was thinking, I'll just do the same for my Mac app, of course, and no.
Really?
Yeah, because they don't do this for the Mac. It doesn't work on the Mac.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Why? Because Apple hates the Mac. Everyone knows that.
Exactly.
It's just crazy how all the features that they have for the Mac, for iOS that they don't have for the Mac. Test flight comes bounding quickly to mind.
Oh, you can't test flight?
No, you can't. Why? Why wouldn't you be able to?
Can you hockey app them?
Sure you can.
Well.
Yeah, hockey works on like all of the platforms.
But could you test flight before test flight was bought by Apple?
No, test flight never supported the Mac, as far as I remember.
Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
And Mark? Mark got me on the hockey app.
Yeah, I don't think Test Flight could. I actually didn't know hockey app could support the Mac. I didn't know that.
Interesting. By the way, Mark Thistle works for Microsoft. We met him at NS North. And he did a talk on writing code for the what do you call it, the Microsoft Band.
Oh. So
he's one of the iOS developers at Microsoft.
Interesting.
Yeah, so yeah, he's a friend of the show. I think that's kind of how he became a friend of the show too, as well. Oh. Yeah, I have the banner, smart banners on my device tracker site, and on our True Life site we have them, of course, as well. So,
is he involved in the Microsoft Garage group, or is he more on the productivity app side?
I'm not sure what Garage means. So,
it's a group within Microsoft that does projects that are, you know, off the main beaten path of Microsoft. They're not working on Word or Excel or that kind of stuff. Like they have one called Toss Up that just came out, which is kind of interesting, where you can you can sort of use it to poll your friends about things. You know, you create a question, you send out to your friends, they all respond. Right. You can use it for like, hey, where should we go for a beer tonight? You know, this place or this place, and they respond, and it figures out what the you know, the winning responses and then notifies everybody, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a silly little app, but it's you know, it's fairly well done, and it's just strange for Microsoft to put out something like that, and you know, but yeah. It's interesting that they're doing that kind of stuff.
Well, like I said, Mark works on the iOS group on the I know Microsoft Band. So if you're an out there and you're a developer and you're interested in working on the Microsoft Band, Mark Thistle's the guy to get in touch with. I'll put his Twitter handle in the show notes so you guys can hook up with him. Well, and so the other follow-up items we had were following up on the conversation we had about Brent Simmons' posts, and there were two other guys. Aaron, help me out here.
Oh, I have got I'll just go back from the notes here. Tough Love by Curtis Herbert and right. Alan Pike writing Supply Side Blues.
Right. So in that sort of vein, there was a couple of follow-up items. One of them was from Charles Perry of Medikite and also of one of the hosts of the Release Notes podcast. He posted a piece about Apple's delivery system and how people sort of look at the 30% we pay to Apple as kind of a harsh thing to have to pay, a lot of money to have to pay, a lot of percentage, that kind of thing. And he looked at it from the point of view, well, what Apple's doing for us is they're our delivery mechanism. They're taking the money, they're, you know, delivering the product to the client, they're helping the client install it on their device, which is stuff that we don't have to get into. And so his all the kind of negative statements we make about Apple and the App Store, he challenges us to substitute Apple or App Store with delivery truck or my delivery truck. And would you say the same things? Like, would you complain about your UPS driver? I mean, everybody knows I would complain about my UPS driver.
Indeed, you would.
Yeah, but would you use that same kind of, would you, you know, have that same kind of vitriol for a delivery person, if that were the person who's, you know, helping you distribute your apps? And I think I've made that point before, but
that way of thinking makes complete 100% sense to me. I've probably said this kind of thing before. There's never really been a time when the App Store was helping you sell your apps, right? Mm-hmm. I've been doing this since what, 2008, and it was never really doing that. So it amazes me when people still expect it to.
Right.
Can I be the dissenting opinion then?
Of course.
Okay.
You mean the contrary? I think the official term is contrarian.
Good.
Yep.
Choose what term you will. I think that, you know, I agree with you that that we shouldn't expect the App Store to sell our apps for us. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the delivery truck analogy is, to my mind, deeply flawed. Because a delivery truck is simply an intermediary between the company selling you the thing and the customer buying it, right?
Right, yeah.
And the App Store is not that.
How about an ice cream truck? You go to the ice cream truck?
Where they own the ice cream. Okay, yeah. Because, well, you know, the big thing you lose is all of the flexibility and all of the relationship with your customer, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, prior to the App Store, independent developers would be able to create a relationship with their customer. They'd be able to take the money directly from the customer. They would know exactly who the customer is and could communicate with them. They could sell upgrades at discounted prices. All these things that you cannot do in the App Store anymore. Mm-hmm, And so it's a much larger issue than the medium of transportation between buyer and seller. This is way more complex than that. And this, you know, delivery truck analogy doesn't come close to addressing the problems that are actually here in the App Store, to my mind.
So, yes, that makes sense. But my point, I guess, would be that it's never done that. It's never given you the chance to have a relationship with your customer. It's never given you the chance to give discounts on that. So, and we're now, what, almost 7 years into it? So it's sort of time to get over it. It is what it is. Either deal with it or don't.
So, Aaron, do you remember I've just finished the, a couple of weeks ago, I finished the Becoming Steve Jobs biography, which you recommended to me. Do you remember what the story was about the App Store in that book? I remember there was a bit about it at the end there.
They resisted it for quite a while.
Yeah,
as I recall. Mm-hmm. Was it something in particular you're thinking of?
Well, yeah, they resisted the whole concept of they wanted to have a walled garden and curate it and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's part of what the App Store was trying to do at the very beginning, because the whole approval process is all about that. You know, they want to basically vet the apps. They want to make sure that we meet a certain standard of delivery. And for that service of checking our work, they charge 30%, I guess, you know, among other things, you know. But I just thought maybe you might remember what the tale was. I don't remember that. I remember it being mentioned in the book, but I don't remember the specifics about it.
Oh, you might remember back in the day, like prior to the App Store launch, I think Steve was quoted as saying something about bringing down the entire West Coast network with a runaway app, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that concern seemed kind of front and center, even if it's ridiculous on its face. But the idea is that, you know, there could easily be bad actors on the phone if not for a vetting process. And so that's right. You know, like I get why there is an app review process, for example. Sure. You know, yeah, and that's one thing, but
and also the idea that they sign the apps. I mean, like I do know that there's part of the mechanism of launching an app is that it actually does check its signature, does check the even when it's downloaded. It's part of the reason why it's signed is to make sure that you're not getting a sort of a man in the middle version of it. I'm not sure if that's the right term or not, but
yeah, fair enough.
And look at where we are today. I mean, again, what is it? Flash 18 today.
Yeah.
Or yesterday, I guess, hacker something or other
team, hacker team,
hacker team. And maybe you can fill me on who they are, but yeah, they've uncovered or released a whole bunch of information that proves that every single version of Flash, including 18, has all kinds of vulnerabilities in it, which could cause your device, your Mac, to crash, and you know stuff that they. And I laughed when I thought about that, because I know that Steve didn't want Flash on the iOS, not because he was worried that he just didn't like Adobe. He was mad at Adobe at the time.
Well, it's also a deeply flawed technology.
And here we are, 18 versions later, and we're still having to hump along with this stuff. I mean. Yeah. I know, like I hear it from the other members of my family. The kids love playing Flash games. You know, there's all these sort of fly trap websites that they go to play these little click on this games kind of stuff, right? And you posted something today about removing Flash. Is that something you would do on your devices, Aaron?
I just did it. Yeah, that's why I posted, because I finally just realized that I should do it. Yeah. Yeah. The heck with that noise. Get rid of it.
And so what happens when you go to a website that has a Flash requirement or something like that?
Well, it'll show up blank, right? And I won't be able to play it, but it hasn't happened yet. I don't know. I think the time for Flash is long past. We've seen it come and go. Like YouTube was the big holdout, right? I guess those games, but iOS has replaced all those crappy web games with crappy iOS games.
Well, yeah.
So I don't know, like kids these days, I don't think they do sit on web browsers anymore on PCs.
Oh, I have one grandson who would rather sit in front of the Mac.
Okay, well, everybody's got one person, but I mean, in large, I'm talking about, you know.
Yeah. I would certainly like to see the end of Flash. I mean, I learned it under duress and supported it for many years, and never really was a big fan of it, you know. But
Facebook doesn't use Flash for their games, do they?
Sorry, who?
Facebook. I don't know.
I don't think so.
I would know. I don't go on to Facebook.
I think a lot of people do and play games on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. God knows they do.
Yeah.
That's true. You know, I think that now that you mention that, there is a lot. There's that whole sort of marketing market of, you know, again, those sort of flytrappy kind of Facebook pages that draw you into these, you know, they have all these sort of social network connected games as part of being a Facebook developer you can tap into, right? That, you know, your friends, so-and-so is playing, you know, Friends with Words or whatever on Facebook, and, you know, you have to communicate with them, so jump over there, right? So, you know, it's interesting that kind of, you know, the kind of instant notification and, you know, constantly being in touch with everybody is a millennial problem, which fortunately we're all too old to have to deal with, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about that. I'm on Twitter all day. Isn't that the same thing, really?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. So, I mean, you know, have you got staying in touch with other people, like, you know, working remote like you do, is that something that's really important to you? And can you turn off those devices and turn the notifications off on your phone and your watches and just hunker down and get work done? I mean, isn't that kind of sort of what you do in your daily work?
I check on Twitter, pretty much steadily as I'm working. Yeah. I don't know. It's just part of my flow. It's what I do. You know, it's, I don't know. I guess scientifically speaking, it's poor for concentration, so they say, but it's the way I work. And so I don't know. But yeah, like I'm, it's my water cooler. You know, I sort of regard it as, you know, the place that, that I can be in touch with other people without having to be there.
Sure. Well, and for me, it's Slack. I do a little bit of Twitter and then I do a little bit of Slack. And then, but I tend to, I tend to consciously, you know, tune out of it and get back to work for a while. Because I actually have an app on my Mac that keeps track of what I'm doing during the day. And it's disturbing when I go back there and see that I spent an hour on Slack and half an hour on Twitter. And, you know, I should have been making billable work, right?
Well, with Slack, presumably you're doing real work stuff, right? Or is that not the case?
Well, it's a bit of both, right? It's a lot of having fun and stuff like that. But yeah, totally. I use Slack to you know, find out about technologies and ask questions. I mean, I'm on a technical group, right? But there's a lot of shenanigans that goes on in that group too.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
We were talking about poutine in our last episode, and that kind of worked its way into the Slack conversation for about a day and a half. Not solid, but still. Another follow-up item that we talked about, it's sort of related to what we talked about, and on the same two subjects, was a post by, saw his name a minute ago, the Speed of Light guy, what's his name?
Oh, yeah, jeez. Why don't people put their damn names on their stuff?
This guy.
Jason Brennan.
Jason Brennan wrote this Speed of Light article, and it's a follow-up on it pretty much echoes what we were saying last week about the whole talk about the posts from, he mentions Brent Simmons' post, he also mentions Alan Pike's as well. But what I really liked about his thing was, you know, was turning it around, and we talked about this, I talked about this with a couple of friends of mine yesterday, about turning the pitch from Mad Men, the TV show, was if you don't like the conversation, change the conversation, and what I picked up from that was the line in his article where he talks about, you know, why don't they value our apps? You know, when we ask, you know, about these people who want to spend, you know, they want to spend 99 cents, you know, they want the app for free. Why don't they value our apps? And he suggests we turn the question around and say, why aren't our apps valuable to people? Right. In other words, you know, maybe they don't want to pay for them because there really isn't that anything more than a dollar's worth of value in them, right?
I think it's much more likely that people see so many free options that they just have been inured to the idea of paying.
Well, and you know, in a sort of analogy to what I was just talking about with notifications, we've become so used to having to respond to things because we're prompted by the same kind of mechanism that makes us think that why would I pay $4 for an app, right?
Yeah.
You know, shouldn't it be free? Like, who is this guy in Whitby who wants me to pay all this money for his app, right?
Well, that's it, you know. And how can you define value for all of the customers that you might have? It's impossible to do. I read something today, and I can't even remember where it was from. So if I come across it, I'll try to send you the link and put it in the show notes. But the fellow had drawn a diagram, and it was like basically a bar chart showing the cost to develop an app as the bottom part of the graph, the price that you're selling it at, which is a little higher, and then the value, which should be higher than your price, right?
Right, right.
And so the distance between the cost and the price is your profit.
Right.
But the distance between the profit and the value is how much the customer is getting out of it.
Right.
And so
right.
What you're trying to do is provide the value for every customer, but every customer, of course, is going to value it differently. I'll give you an example, because last night we were at Taco, right? You remember that?
Yeah, I was there.
We ran into, Magpie's number one fan. Sohail Ahmed, who's a listener of the show, hey Sohail, had some kind words to say about Magpie, and he was very much into it because, like me, he sees the value of the app. You know, he has the same problem that I have, running into all these videos all day and needing to watch them later somehow using some mechanism. And so Magpie fits the bill for him. It's a huge value for him. And so he's purchased it, and he's getting a lot more value out of it than what he paid for it. But most people will look at an app and not see the value. right?
Right.
I'm like,
right.
Well, I don't, because they probably don't even get what the app does, right?
Well,
then you could argue that for that person, then it doesn't necessarily have any value. I mean, it's very hard to quantify. You know, what is $5 worth of value, or whatever the number is. So for this person that you just mentioned, you know, maybe if it saves them an hour a day, then yeah, you could probably argue that his time is worth way more than that. So there's definitely value. But you know, if a person isn't, this is sort of obvious. If a person isn't spending time using a thing, and then how do you put a monetary value on it?
It doesn't have any in that case, of course. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, so is time money? If time is money, then of course, then you can easily say, if this saved me, you know, 5 minutes a day, then after X number of days, it will have been worth the $5 investment I put into it, based on some calculation, right? Mm-hmm. But this is going to be different for every person, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm curious about this chart, not being able to see it, but you're saying that the cost to do the app is the bottom line, and then it's slightly higher than that is what you're selling it for, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so are you saying that we should, and this may be a way to think about it, we should be figuring out what the cost per user is to build an app? Is that what you're saying? Like,
well, you know, there's... Oh, you know what? It was Sean.
Because it costs you way more than you've not. There's no, you're nowhere near, you know, with your 20 sales or whatever it is, you're nowhere near making what you put into it so far.
Of course. Right? Of course.
Yeah, I think a lot of the problem is that, you know, we do what a lot of people do. You know, a lot of engineers, a lot of developers, a lot of hobbyists kind of do is we build something because we think it's interesting and we think it's fun and we want to work on it. Rather than trying to figure out what is the market out there that needs to be addressed and what is the value of that market, and then going backwards and saying, okay, if the market for this thing is, you know, the total market of this thing is $1,000 a year, and I'm going to spend $100,000 of my time and effort to build the thing, then that's a bad market, right? And but I think we all do that. You know, we do something that has value for us, and we build something that has value for us, without necessarily paying attention to whether it has a lot of value for the market as a whole. I think a lot of startups in particular do this. I mean, there's hundreds of startups that have this great idea, you know, get some funding, build this thing, and, you know, just because you build it, then they'll come. I mean, that doesn't really work.
Yeah. Too true.
Yeah, I've been telling customers that for the last 5 years, is just because you build it. Same thing with websites, right? People think, I'll put this great website up there, and it'll magically start churning a profit, you know?
Right. And there was a time when that happened just because it happened to be the right point in time, right?
Yeah.
And there weren't many people doing it, and it was just a magic time. Same with apps, right? There was first year or two of the App Store, there was tons of money made by people who just happened to be there at the right time.
Well, because and back then it was like shooting fish in a barrel, because you had, like, you know, a very small percentage of people who actually owned phones, but they needed to have apps on their phone, right?
Exactly.
And the other thing too, I guess, is how do people find apps these days? Like, you know, Sohail hopefully is going around telling everybody about how wonderful Magpie is, and, you know,
bless his heart. Oh, I love that guy.
We're talking about it on the podcast right now. You've got a website set up for it, you know. You know, we put a little banner up on our site, so people will maybe click on it when nobody has, by the way, but they will on it when they come to this site. How are people finding out about apps right now? So I don't think it's as simple as, you know, putting a video up on the App Store or putting a good description or whatever. I think that there's still a lot to be said for word of mouth. Of, you know, like, from, I mean, I can tell you right now, Aaron, I have used your app twice today because I had two videos that I started to watch and realized, okay, well, let me just throw this into Magpie. I'll check it out later, you know? And now I know it's sitting in Magpie waiting for me to go back to at some point in the future, right? So whether it's on my Mac or my iOS device, which, again, is great.
Pretty
right?
darn handy.
Yeah, it is. You know, I to be honest with you, I would never have, if you hadn't written that Magpie and you hadn't told me about Magpie and you hadn't, you know, really urged me to install it on my devices, I probably would never even found out about it or even used it, right? Because I wouldn't have been able to find it on the App Store.
Nope.
You know, exactly. Unless I was in there, you know, trying to solve a specific problem and stumbled across this particular app, right?
So yeah, that's the pickle, right? Like how to get the word out in an effective way.
So can I ask you, Aaron, what are you doing to get the word out?
I'm not doing much of anything. Yeah. I don't really have one, you know? Like, the press is really my only real avenue, and like from a PR perspective and not a marketing one.
Yeah.
Just continuing to improve the app, continuing to let the people in the press know about it, and hoping that one day they'll put pen to paper on me and let people know about it.
Well, I think, and we talked about this 2 weeks ago in the last episode, and, you know, Mark is going to jump in here and help me with this one too, but you definitely got to do something on PR Mac, because it's very simple way to get the word out about the app. You're already, you know, you're very eloquent in your verbiage. You can write up a couple of paragraphs on it, some links to the website, to the links to the app store itself, you know, do a press release, right?
Yeah.
I think as most is $20 or something like that.
Yeah, it's very cheap. And for something like this, actually, I think it could be pretty useful. You know, for some of the things that I've used it for in the past, it hasn't been that great because it doesn't necessarily reach the niche markets that I was going for, but this is not a niche market, right? This is something that potentially a lot of people could use. So just sending it out to a very widespread, large audience might not be a bad idea.
Well, I can tell you that about 7-8 years ago, I was working as a journalist in writing tech articles, and to this day, I still get press releases in my mail. You know, and I look at them. Occasionally I see one that I think, I'll go and put that on my blog and, you know, basically spit it out there for people. But, you know, it just, you know, it's sort of an in one of those secret sort of societies of information, the press release sort of circle, right? So my device tracker ended up on Mac Surfer. Do you know MacSurfer.com?
Yeah.
Familiar with that? So yeah, the aggregator. One day, you know, I'm sure I saved a screenshot of it because my app showed up on there. It's one of their picks, right? How? I don't know. Or why? I don't know. But it was there because of the press release, right? So,
Have you thought about, and this may be anathema to what you'd normally like to do, but have you thought about buying ads on Google that are targeted towards YouTube?
I've used AdWords in the past and been really screwed by it because it is... It's a business model that really seems to really favor Google and them getting more money out of you for less payoff. So I have, you know, having used it in the past and been burned, I'm much less likely to do something like that.
Right. Started me thinking about that was, so normally what I would generally do to try to think about marketing is try to figure out where are the people who potentially going to use the app. Like, I wrote poker apps, so we would go into poker communities and talk to them. Music apps, I would go into a music community, music websites. So, but there really aren't a lot of, you know, websites for people who like to watch videos online, right? Well, maybe there are, but...
I don't know about them, yeah.
But, yeah. So, where do people go to watch videos online? Well, they go to YouTube.
Yeah.
So if I'm looking at YouTube and there's... You know, whenever I go, I like to go onto YouTube and look at, like, music videos and things like that. So inevitably, I'm just kind of clicking. I watch one, click another one, click another one, and just follow that thread down. And I forget where I am a lot of times, right? Because I've been following links. So that would be a perfect time for me to see an ad for Magpie and say, oh, this solves that problem for me.
Yeah, there's also a tag you can put into the app in terms of what documents you support. Can somebody play can you have your iOS device offer up Magpie as a choice for a player? Because, you know, when you play a video on the iOS device, 9 times out of 10, it wants to show it in YouTube. Have you looked into that, Aaron, at all?
No, I haven't. I know what you mean. I think that's something that YouTube does internally.
No, but there's an enum that you can put in to support different types of apps, right? Or different types of document formats, as it were, right? Like, if your app can open a Word document, there's an enum you can put in there that tells the system that you can support this file format, right? Similar to what I was talking about earlier with the device tracker import, right? Because I had to register one of the capabilities, I think, in Xcode. I'm just drawing a blank on what it's called right now, but... But I also wanted to talk about something else. We're used to working in tech support for companies that sold image setters and films and stuff like that. And I remember an AGFA representative once was telling me about how, you know, and there was a time there when they were making good money, the salespeople. And I asked them, so how do you figure out, you know, what you're going to make in a year. You're, you know, because sales is kind of one of those loose end things too. Like, you have no idea where the income's coming from. And what he told me he did was he would say, okay, I want to make this amount of money in a year, right? And so he would take that and break it down into four. And he would say, okay, well then, if I want to make this much money in a year, I need to make this much money this quarter. And if I need to make this much money this quarter, I need to sell, you know, I need to hit up this many clients, and I need to, you know, sell, you know, and he'd figure out some sort of formulaic way of what his goals were for that quarter. And I'm kind of wondering if, using your analogy, but the chart with the price of the app per user, or the cost of the app per user to build, you know, the price you're going to sell it at, and I forgot the third criteria was, but maybe we should be looking at how we determine whether an app has viability by that kind of formula. Like, break it down backwards. Like, you know, what is it? If I want to sell this app to 1,000 users, right? How much is it going to cost me to build it, and how much should I sell it for? But if I want to sell this app to 10,000 users, or 1,000,000 users, or, you know, like, God forbid, the Clash of Clans kind of sales numbers, you know, like, they can probably build they can spend $1 million on a commercial because they're easily making that in a week, you know, or less.
Indeed. I think that's a very healthy way to approach the sale of an app.
And at a $5, at a $5 price point, you know, minus, you know, the 30% that Apple's taking, put to, let's say $4, right? Whatever.
or $6 Canadian. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or $3 Canadian.
It's not unreasonable then to have a cost per install of a couple of bucks, yeah, that you're mm-hmm. paying in ads, and you're still making money. It's very different than on a 99-cent one, because you know you'll never get your cost of install. You're never going to be able to make money off a 99-cent app, but using ad, like something like AdWords. But for a $5 app, you maybe you can. I would look into it.
Yeah, because actually you just said that, because there's another way that there's that other side of advertising, in that the cost per install, and I think Facebook uses that model with their in-app or their ad models, right? So, because they do iOS ads as well, and they can tell you whether the ad that you sold on Facebook coincided with an install of it on the device, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm not sure about with Facebook ads, but for sure with Google ads, you can specify your target in terms of cost per install, as opposed to cost per click or CPM or whatever.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And they'll target your campaign to try to get you that price.
Yeah, you can do some target marketing with Facebook as well. Like, you can sort of say, I want, you know, males between this age, and I want them to be in the United States, and I want them to be, you know, I don't know. You can narrow it down so that, you know, it's only going to a certain demographic.
Yeah. Yep.
What have you? You know, people who are, you know, went to school and studied engineering and architects and, you know, whatever, wherever your market is, and then the spend. You say, you know, I'm going to spend $50, let's say, and you say I'll spend $50 within this time period, and when the $50 is done, the ad campaign stops, and you know, you see how many you get, right? You figure work it backwards. But I was sort of thinking from the point of view, Mark, of what it costs us in terms of effort and time and money, and, you know, to build that app, and how many units we need to sell to basically make that money back.
Right? Sure.
You know, like if somebody's going to come to us and spend, you know, $150,000, how many apps do they need to make, or how much business do they need to generate to get that money back? I would think that the spend with us has got to be a minute percentage of their business.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, if somebody's going to spend $150,000 on an app, they can't be expecting to make that back in sales of the app. They can't reasonably expect that, right?
No.
It's got to be a component of a larger marketing strategy.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I mean, because even for us to spend, you know, and we were talking about this last week, where the new indie developer model is, you go get a day job and you do the app development you want to do in your spare time, and as sort of a hobbyist sort of approach, right?
Welcome to my life.
Mine too.
Yeah.
But even that hobby time, just because it's quote unquote idle time, I think it still has to be valued, and it still has to we still have to perceive it as having value, right? So.
Right, and then you got to decide, well, is it monetary value that it's giving you, or is it some other kind of value? Does working on those apps make you better at building the apps that you're doing for someone else, So sure. you can be more efficient, build them faster, charge a higher rate or whatever. Yeah.
Well, it's like right now, like I said, I think I mentioned before that I've kind of sort of drawn a line in the sand. I'm still working on Objective-C because of the apps that I support and continue to build on, but I've drawn a line in the sand to sort of from this point on. And I think, Aaron, you mentioned last night as well that Swift is the future, right? So.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It's supposed to be.
And it's not, and it's interesting. I was just listening to a talk just before the show here that Swift is the future, but there is still, you know, like if you're doing core data stuff, maybe you use Objective-C there because it's a really low level stuff, and it, you know, you can write it in Swift, but why bother? It's already there. It's a self-contained piece. You know, it has a very specific purpose. So your app can be, you know, Swift mostly, but you still can support it. And of course, you know, all the frameworks from Apple, a majority of them are still in Objective-C, right, as well?
100%, as far as we know.
Yeah.
For me, it's still a productivity thing. If I were to switch to Swift right now, I would lose just a lot of productivity.
Mm. Well, it's just learning curve, you know? You've got to mount that curve before you can be productive in it.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
That's what's happening to me right now, you know? Like, you know, last week on the show, I said that I wouldn't write Swift for Magpie until I was... Well, I wouldn't write Swift for Magpie, period. I was going to do it on a new project. And so...
Okay, drum roll, everybody.
The next day, last Thursday, I started... I opened up a new class for Magpie, and it's in Swift.
And this is inside the app, so you're done with bridging editor.
Yeah, it's no, I haven't done that yet. I've actually got it as a separate project right now, it is intended to be injected into Magpie.
Yeah.
Wait, and it's a class, not a struct?
Yeah, it's a class.
Yeah, I actually finally watched that WWDC video.
Value type,
Not the value type one, the other one,
the protocol-oriented programming
one. Yeah, very interesting stuff.
This is actually it's fully Cocoa, so I don't know. I don't really and I said this at the time, I don't fully understand the protocol oriented programming stuff, and I especially don't see how it integrates in with Cocoa. So what I'm actually doing here is I'm replacing AF networking in large, but not with the Swift class. What I'm actually replacing with the Swift class is UI image view plus AF networking. As well as NS image view plus AF networking, which actually doesn't exist.
So you're replacing that? So that's not the Alamofire version of that?
Right. I'm writing my own NS image view, UI image view, asynchronous loader.
So this raises an interesting point, and we've talked about this on the show, and I've talked about this with Mark privately. Mark, you were always going on about NSURL connection as opposed to using AF networking.
Session.
Yeah. Well, connection. Originally it was connection. Thank you. Now it's moved on to session. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's your position on NSURL session versus things like AF networking, which a lot of people use?
Yeah. You know, I guess I have nothing against AF networking per se. I mean, it's a great library, but just in general, if I can do something myself in a reasonable amount of time, I won't use a third-party library just because then I know what's inside of it. I know what to do if something goes wrong. I know how to work with it. I just know what it's doing. Whereas I found that, you know, in many cases with a third-party library, the more time that goes on, the more likely that it's not going to be supported or that something's going to change in the OS and something will break and where you have to customize something and then it breaks all future releases. And I would just rather not have to deal with that if I don't have to. Obviously, some things you have to. But for me personally, you know, I can do everything I need to do with an NSURL session. And it works fine for me. You know, a lot of that is because I've, you know, just built up this library of stuff over the years, you know, to do a lot of this, a lot of that functionality. So it's not like I'm writing it from scratch every time. So yeah, for me, I just don't have a need for it.
I'm coming around on that myself. You know, that's what I did with Magpie. I actually the 1.0 that's currently in the store uses AF networking, and I just tore it out last week. It's all gone. CocoaPods too, also gone. It was a huge liability in this project, you know, which has targets that are Mac, iOS, frameworks and action extensions, and having CocoaPods integrated into that was just messing things up. AF Networking was a pod that was installed along with it. There's a few other pods too, but I decided to just pull out CocoaPods altogether. It solved a ton of problems. I pulled out AF Networking and very quickly and easily used NS URL Session to replace all the functionality from there.
Yeah.
The only holdover was the NS and UI image view categories. And so I've got it. Like, that's no problem to replace on iOS. There are tons of third-party replacements for that. But on the Mac, there's, like, nothing. So, F it. I'm writing one myself.
Just write your own. Oh. Yeah, it's not that hard to write.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
And so
you write it once and you have it forever.
Yeah, and I'll publish it. I'll make it available because, I mean, I wish that I I'd found someone who had done it already, because I'd rather be working on Magpie than on this. But, you know, now that I've decided to do it, I might as well give it to everybody, and hopefully others will, you know, improve it and get some use out of it themselves.
Cool. Yeah.
And I figured it had to be in Swift, right? If I'm going to give it away, it's got to be in Swift, you know, or else I can't call myself an iOS developer in 2015. That's kind of only.
Let's say 2017.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah.
So, let me do a real time update. I was mentioning that graph earlier about cost, price, and value.
Sure.
That was part of a column written by Sean Blanc in an article that he published today called "The Art of Price and Value." I've got the link. You've got it there, Tim. And and so he does a really nice explanation based on his own product, a book that he wrote called Delight is in the Details. And so he talks about his cost in producing that, the price he sold it for, and the value that his readers get from it, and how to kind of pull those levers to increase the value and make money for himself. So, and he includes that graph that I was telling you about. It's a little hand drawing thing. There, So in the show notes.
How's Magpie doing, by the way, Aaron, before we launch into that?
We talked about it quite a bit last week, but I just actually looked at my sales tonight. I've made 20 sales.
That's not bad.
Okay. Yeah.
And is it the hockey stick kind of chart at the beginning, or just sort of trickling along?
No, right? In fact, my best sales day was day 3. Go figure.
And is it iOS versus Mac? Or
12 iOS and the rest are Mac.
And what are you what are you selling it for? I never actually saw it in the store. $4.99. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I put an article that just came across my desk here from Dan Council about pricing your app.
Yeah.
And he basically said the same thing. $4.99 is kind of a sweet spot for to do anything but freemium.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Freemium doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I've probably read that. Like, I see you have it here. Pretty sure I've looked at it.
I'm not sure. I think you posted it today.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. Pick anything other than freemium. Yeah.
And my friend Matthias Holman put up, we were talking about, I forget where we were talking about this. Oh, I think he was talking to Charles Perry and that on Twitter. And Matthias put up he posted a blog here back in May about a game that he wrote, a Mahjong game. And about what it made for him, I think. What did he say? Just thought we could follow up for our sort of, you know, can you make a living at this kind of stuff? You know, can you?
I actually still think you can, even after all this. You know, even though I'm not doing the indie stuff really so much at all anymore.
Yeah.
Looking back and looking at the mistakes I made and the successes I had, I still do think it's possible. You know that Chinese poker game that I got that I sold for $4.99, that's still selling copies years later. I haven't touched it in years. Scales and Modes still selling copies. Haven't touched it in years. So if I had really, you know, gone all in with the original strategy that I had of just cranking through and making tons of apps, which I was doing for a while, and then I just kind of got bogged down by a couple of things. Running out of good ideas was one problem. It's actually a big problem. You know, coming up with interesting ideas is kind of tough. And actually, probably the biggest problem was the support weight gets heavier and heavier. Every time you do a new app, you have to support all the old apps, And after a while, you start spending more time, or such a large percentage of your time supporting all the old apps that you don't really have so much time to do the new apps. But yet, the new apps are where the money's coming from. So it's kind of a tough balancing point. But I actually do think it's possible. In hindsight.
Well, it's interesting too. But you know, you and I have talked about Device Tracker a number of times over the years, yep. Right? As I've been, you know, updating it for each OS that comes out, and you know, doing the whole, you know, getting rid of the skeuomorphic look and all that kind of stuff. And Aaron, what you don't know is that Mark and I were talking about, you know, refactoring it and getting it up into size classes and all that kind of stuff. And
I didn't know that.
Converting it to storyboard. Well, because it's all done in the old hand-coded table view controller stuff, right?
Yeah, I knew that.
There's not even a nib in the entire file, right? Mm-hmm. And so Mark had sort of said to me, well, you know, why don't you move on to other things? It's not really, you know, it's like, when do you stop working on the app? And I thought, well, fine, I'll just let it ride for a while. And then, you know, in April, was it April, we got statistics from Apple with the iTunes Analytics. Connect stuff?
Yeah.
The analytics, right? I get tons of store views on that app, right? And it's still selling, right? So, and I don't know if it's, you know, halo effect from the podcast or whatever, but, or from, you know, people just finding it. I created a marketing website for it a couple of, you know, 6 months ago, and I was doing all that kind of stuff, right? And now I'm looking at it going, okay, yeah, I really think there is a market for this type of app from me, per se, right? And it's not a, you know, everybody can download it for free kind of thing. It's a specific niche that it services, right? So looking at the numbers I get back from Apple, it's quite a hit. And surprisingly, it seems to be a lot of downloads in Germany. It's about organizing your stuff, and they like to organize their stuff over there as a stereotype.
That's
right?
True.
So
yeah. You know. So then the question is, can you come up with ways to make money off of existing installations?
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing that we talked about in the past. I mean, there's been a few, like, you know, we called it Device Tracker, and it was a friend of mine who helped me with the marketing decision to call it that, right? It was originally like Device Database or something like that, right?
Yep.
And so a marketing guy who helped me write the original marketing pitch for it, you know, said, well, let's call it Device Tracker. It's for keeping track of your devices, right? And so I put it out there and then, you know, kind of staked my claim with that name. And there have been a number of other people who have come out with apps called Device Tracker for iOS, Device Tracker for iPad, and whatever. And the differences they did was they put location services into it, right? So they've got like core location and that kind of stuff. And so that would be something I could do as an in-app purchase, let's say. You know, we could add in the ability to put a geocode in there so you can know which of your many warehouses it might be in, right? And then there's also the idea of adding a barcode scanner to it, because a lot of people with, like, for technical, like, equipment, like servers and computers and stuff like that, when you're managing lots of things, they might have a barcode, right?
Yeah, that one's almost a no-brainer since it's now built in, right?
Yeah, it's super simple. Yeah. I think even one of the Apple guys said to me that I should do that, right?
Yeah.
And one of my clients is a real estate guy. One of the people I got feedback from, he uses it to manage his lockboxes, so he knows which house he's left which particular lockbox and what the combination is, you know? So it's kind of like, you know, little mini inventory.
That's pretty interesting. Thing. Maybe you should skin it specifically for realtors.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just it. I mean, and that's part of what the whole refactoring question was, because you remember we basically wrote it in such a way that, you know, you get a number of fields, you know, that relate to IT-related stuff, like IP address, MAC address, you know, hard drive space, that kind of thing, you know, make and model. And there, even though we had moved them towards customized fields, it's still a hard-coded thing. And so the last thing I was working on before I stopped working on it was the ability for users to go in and customize those field labels, right? So, mm-hmm. so my wife wants me to, and I've actually got another sort of inventory app that my wife wants me to build, which is a variation of this. So I may go to that. And in fact, I may decide just to, I'm kind of torn because, you know, I got a lot of users, they've got a lot of data in their thing, and I've got that way of importing and exporting data, which I learned about from RayWenderlich.com, ding. But I'm concerned about my legacy users, and how do I, if I come out with a Device Tracker 2, or if I just revamp this app from the very beginning, how do I get those guys to be able to bring their information along with them, right? So, because mm-hmm. we're using an NS Coder or
key archivers. Yeah, the old school stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, to you know, export and then import the file into the system by just parsing through it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, then so you just probably write an importer then.
Yeah. So I said, I mean, like, I have a file format, right? In fact, I have two file formats because we changed the name of it from the very, very first one. And if I made a new version of it, I would just make it be able to support that, right? So, and even on the IT perspective, you know, the system info report that comes off a Mac is an XML file, and we can parse that and have it automatically bring stuff in, right? So. Mm-hmm. At one time, Aaron, we talked about making a Mac version of it, and then you could, you know, go in with import data from Excel and stick it in the Mac version, and then sync it to your iOS version. You know, very similar to what you're doing with Magpie, in that sense. You know.
Yeah.
You know, so. I think you need a watch app for it.
Well, I started working on the Pi Day Countdown watch app.
Oh, nice. Was that your first app ever, the Pi Day Countdown?
No, the first app ever was Two for Couples. I started writing on a customer app.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. Actually, Device Tracker was probably our first app because it was based on an app that I had written as a web app many years ago, right? So I already had the concept down, right? The business case down.
Yeah.
So Pi Day Countdown was written on a whim. Like we used to have an Apple conference here for Apple technicians and education Apple people in the education market, and it was always around March 14th. And Steve Heyman, who's Apple engineer here, Apple system engineer here, he is a huge fan of Pi Day. So we wrote the app in such a way that we hoped that we could have it announce it, you know, the day before the conference, and then on Pi Day everybody could count down to Pi Day at the same time. But oh well. It didn't get through approved to the store fast enough. It got approved the morning of March 14th,
yeah.
So, ironically. But when we were talking about Matthias Holman's Mahjong game, right, and how he posted his numbers, and I think the other piece was the post from Dan Council about choosing the right pricing model for your app, right? And basically what we've been saying over the last couple of episodes is that, you know, you should pick a number that makes sense and it's not, don't price it down too low. I think we talked about the pricing of Magpie last week, didn't we, Aaron? About the fact that, you know, that $4.99 is a decent price and maybe it should be a little higher. Who knows? You know.
I think I talked a little bit about that, yeah. But, yeah, whenever I talk to people about the price of Magpie, whenever I say it's $4.99, they tend to draw in their breath very quickly and look away.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They're like, oh, wow, that's way too much. Your app isn't nearly that valuable.
Well, yeah.
And so, and I tend to ignore that sort of thing, because I don't care.
No, exactly. Yeah, you're in this for the long haul. I mean, that's the whole point, right?
Exactly, so. So, yeah. If people don't want to buy it, then if they don't want that value in their lives, then they're welcome to not have it. That's cool with me.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I have been thinking, you know, in turns, various, you know, I'm back and forth all the time, but I think about raising the price from time to time. I don't think I'll ever drop it below $4.99 unless I'm on some kind of crazy sale.
Well, it would be interesting to see what would happen there if you did have a sale.
Yeah.
And see if you got you dropped it $2.99 to get a more than 2x increase in sales, and then that tells you something. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That people like to get a deal. I think that's what it would tell me. It would
that's
a better price. Unless it were sustained.
Yeah, that's true. Yep.
Yeah, I know. Like some experiments might happen. Who knows?
The sticker shock thing, though, it is real. I mean, I'm totally with you. I probably told the story before, but one time way back when, one of my $1.99 apps was featured on a podcast, and the person who was talking about it was, you know, she really liked the app. She was talking about how she was, you know, playing it on the subway. It was a game app. It was a casual gaming kind of app. It was the Look Again app. It's the pattern matching one. And she was saying how, she played it on the subway and, you know, probably spent a half an hour playing it. And it was really pretty fun. And then she said, but, and everyone kind of pauses on the podcast, it was $1.99. And there was that gasp.
No.
Yeah, there was that gasp. Yeah. And they were all kind of shocked. It was $1.99.
You got ripped off, girlfriend.
But she spent, you know, she spent a half an hour playing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, she would probably spend twice that much on a Starbucks and drink it in 10 minutes. Right? And so I just don't get it. system.
Yeah, well, we were having a discussion amongst a couple of other guys, and one of them was telling about his app. And I mean, I had originally put iAds into Device Tracker, and then I didn't like the execution. And when it first came out, it was only Disney and JCPenney because it was like $1 million buy-in or something like that. So there was not going to be any real advertising going on. So I pulled it out of the app in the original days, right? I think I only have one app on the store that has iAds in it. But he was telling me that he's put iAds and AdMob into his apps. Mm. And the AdMob stuff actually does make him a pretty penny. I think it might even be in Matthias's blog post here, right? You not talk about AdMob in there?
Yeah, I don't know. You can check that. But, you know, I've certainly talked to other people about the success rate for ads. And, you know, some people who have popular apps can earn a good living from ad networks.
Right.
I'm just never going to do that. I don't believe in that.
Yep.
As a business model.
I don't believe in it as a, you know, it's, I don't want to gunk up my app with that crap.
Yeah. Oh, here it is. So in Matthias's post, he talks about the paid version of the Mahjong app at $2.99, and then he dropped it down to 99 cents. He made 640 euros. Profit. I'm not sure what the time frame for that is.
Yeah, but time frame is everything.
I'm not sure. I think, well, it looks like the chart here shows a couple of months, right? Actually, when did he publish it? Anyway, but then, interestingly enough, though, he has a free version of it, and he had 20,000 downloads of that app, 20 to 30 a day, per se, and basically with the ad mob in it, he made 7,400 euros. Right, in the same time period. So, interesting, you know?
Yeah, a significant difference.
And it's all based on AdMob interstitials, which is
those are the best, better ones.
They are the best CPMs, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, sure. They just make me want to, like, flip every table from here to Europe.
Yeah,
true. I don't like that, and I'm not putting that in my app. It's just not happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, then that's the thing. It's like, how do you pay for this stuff? You're either bootstrapping it, or like you said, you have to draw a line in the sand and say, I'm selling it for $4.99 and I'm happy about that, right? You know, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I may have talked about this in the past, but you know, in the desktop publishing days when everybody ran out and bought image setters, and I mean, not everybody did. They were $80,000 pieces of equipment just to print some film and, you know, do some prepress work, right? And so you used to have film houses that you would go to get, you know, your work converted into printable film that you could then take and have plates and, you know, put in a magazine or something like that, right?
I used to do that too.
Yeah, and do you remember when it went down to like $1 a page? Like, this is the whole desktop publishing, you know, race to the bottom. It's the same thing happened in desktop publishing that happened in the App Store over the last couple of years, and that, you know, it basically squeezed everybody out of the market who felt they were there because they were craftspeople or whatever, right? I mean, the majority of them stayed there, but the people, there was a whole bunch of fast, you know, what do you call them, fast buck guys, quick change artists, right? Who came in and they had the cappuccino machine in the front of the store, and you could, you know, get your cappuccino and buy your thing, and they were making money selling cappuccinos while they were printing your page for a buck, right?
Yeah.
You know, with a bunch of young guys in the back working in a sweatshop out putting these things, and yeah. You know, it was all and they would make money on doing changes and, you know, fixing up your file if it was wrong or whatever. But the lost leader was the dollar a page, right?
So they probably made a lot more on the cappuccino than on anything else.
Yeah, and the thing about it is, back then, I mean, if you factored in the cost of the equipment and the price for chemicals and buying the film from, you know, Agfiz and the Kodaks of the day, you know, it costs more than $1 a page. That's the sad part, right? So it's like, you know, it's sort of where we are now. We were talking about this a bit, I think, yesterday after the TACO meeting yesterday, Aaron. It was that you have to put so much effort into the app, right? So that's why the price has to be where it is, right? Realistic, I think, in my opinion, you know.
Well, yeah, like absolutely. I agree.
Sure.
You know, and if somebody wants to hire us out, it's like we were talking about this as well before the meeting, I think, right? You know, if somebody comes to us with an app that they want to build, and we factor in how much effort it's going to take to, you know, do high level architecture, have somebody code it, do some design work, quality assurance, you know, like you were just saying before we started recording, Mark. You know, that involves a team of people who, you know, expect to be paid a certain wage. And by the time you add up all the hours it takes to build an app, especially an iPad app, right, you're up in the hundreds of thousands of dollars easily, right? You know? And you can't, so you can't turn around and sell that for free, right? Unless you've got some crazy ad revenue scheme, right? So,
right.
Or VCs, or, you know, it's yeah. actually just a piece of the overall business.
Exactly.
You know, there are lots of situations where, you know, apps can be developed and have a business justification to pay for it, and that has nothing to do with the price of it on the App Store.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I mean, and that's just it. I mean, like, if you look at a retailer or somebody who's providing a service, that their business, or the reason people go to them is not for an app on the App Store. The reason they go to them is for some other service or some other business, and they happen to have an app, right? Then they got to give that away for free, and, you know, and people expect it to
yeah, your bank is a classic example of that, right? They don't,
yeah,
they're never going to sell you an app, but you know, right. you're using your services way more because you have it. Starbucks is another one too, right? You have their app, you're more likely to go into the store because, well, yeah, I've got some cash on the phone, I'll just, you know, go in and use it. Yeah.
I mean, to be honest with you, you hit the nail right on the head. I love using the Starbucks app myself. You know, I was standing in line the other day, you know, and getting a coffee or something like from the guy, and when it came time to pay, I just said, "Hang on a second," and I charged up my card. I charged up my app and then paid with the app. Right, I'm like, rather than reaching in my pocket and pulling out a $5 bill or whatever, right? So
the only thing that bugs me, I love it too, but the only thing that bugs me right now is you can't use Apple Pay to recharge your Starbucks card. Rude. I don't know why you can't do that. That's crazy.
That's such a shame.
Yeah. Anyway.
So what is this Apple Pay you speak of?
Yeah, right.
Apple Pay? I thought you have Apple Pay in Canada now.
No.
They're getting it in the UK. United Kingdom, they're getting it, I think, next week in the UK, I believe, right? But yeah, we're getting it in November or something like that. You know, just in time for Christmas, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, if you like using your Starbucks card, honestly, you'll love Apple Pay.
Well, actually, one of the students I was teaching is an American, and he has his watch enabled with Apple Pay, so he's been paying for stuff all over the city by waving his wrist under various payment devices here in Canada. So
at 70 cents on the dollar. Must love that.
Oh, yeah. I guess. Is that what it is?
Something stupid like that. I don't want to think about it. It makes me ill.
Mm-hmm. So we only have one pick this week, so I'll just jump in. Basically, I saw today that there was an update came out from Mac Update. They've got a bundle that includes a bunch of interesting apps. There's some FTP clients. There's an SQLite app, a bunch of other things. But two of the included pieces that we talked about on the show before, one of them is PAW, and I believe we talked about Dash before for the document management.
We must have, yeah.
App, yeah. But these are part of the Mac Update bundle, and I think it's $59 US, and it's I basically bought it today because I was going to buy PAW anyway. Who was it that brought PAW to our table?
I totally brought PAW.
Totally
brought PAW.
I believe it was some guy named Aaron brought
that it. Wouldn't
yeah.
be me.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I would like to take full credit.
So there's a couple of other things. You know, I was talking to some people this morning about, like, why you would need an SQLite, you know, a tool to basically dig into stuff. I mean, I use a free one for Core Data, but I guess, and Aaron, you were saying that you built Magpie last week using SQLite 3, but not Core Data, right?
Correct.
And so how do you visualize what you're doing there?
I'm a command line guy.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Okay.
Interesting. I didn't realize that, Aaron. So what made you choose to do that? To not use Core Data.
I'm just curious. Too bad you weren't on the show last week.
Yeah.
Maybe I should explain my. I have a little bit of antipathy against Core Data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Dr. Rubin, I've got a problem. I'm hoping I can sit on your couch and you can help me out. All right. I did it from a very pragmatic position. You know, and I'll just hasten to add here that I have quite a bit of experience with Core Data. The job that I'm working with my client now, using a very large piece of software, it's all Core Data. Mm-hmm. I'm deep, deep in the weeds with Core Data, all over it, and not a fan.
Really?
There's just so many complicating factors to Core Data that you have to keep track of, and I feel like it could be a lot simpler.
That it's not thread safe is...
The fact that it's not thread safe. I'm just going to stop you right there.
Yeah. You don't really have to say much more. Although, private key private queue concurrency made it a lot better than it used to be.
Yes, it did. It did. But it's not there yet. And it's there's still a lot of complications to deal with. So, but pragmatically speaking for MagPie, there's one object. It's a video object. And there's no relationships. There's no second object. And so I kept it as simple as possible. And so using a SQL sort of database on the device just makes all the problems go away. And because I have a ton of experience with it already, so it was really straightforward a decision to make to just go with that.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense. If you don't have relationships, you lose a lot of the value of core data, for sure. Mm-hmm. That's the power of core data. You don't have to do joins or anything like that. You just
yeah.
I mean they're there, but they're under the hood. They're hidden from you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Cool.
Yeah. So that was that. Sorry, you were talking about Mac Update Bundle, though. And I'm looking at this thing, and it's really impressive. There's a lot of good apps in here.
Yeah. So I just opened it myself. So it comes with Hype, Delta Walker, Dash, Flux, Paw, Forklift, which is an FTP thing. Base is the tool for SQLite, and Code Runner, which I've heard of before, but I'm not
quite actually familiar. I have Code Runner as well.
Do you?
Yeah, it's I don't actually use it that often, but it is a I used it more in my web development days.
Sure, yeah.
Because it would allow you to what Code Runner does is allows you to run code within like a sort of like a sandbox sort of environment, if you will. Mm-hmm. So you can try things out, sort of like in a Rails situation, for example, you can run it right against your development environment without actually having to run the application. So it made it really easy to try things out.
Sort of like Playgrounds in Swift.
Oh, yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, very much like Playgrounds in Swift. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which, and because of the way Objective-C is, where you can't really, there's no, what's it called? Read a REPL, you know, there's no REPL in Objective-C, you know, Ruby has a REPL and Swift has a REPL. And that's, you know, that's why they're, you know, you're able to have a playground in Swift because you got this read eval print loop that you can just hit with and get results back immediately. Whereas with Objective-C, of course, you have to compile it. Right. And so you cannot try things out, quote unquote, in Code Runner using Objective-C, even though Code Runner does support Objective-C. It's kind of in a hacky way. It uses like sort of a framework project, and it's not as nice as with Ruby, for example. Mm-hmm. So, still cool app, but I think Playgrounds have really superseded it in that sense.
So for those of our listeners who don't know what a REPL is, can you explain what that is?
Oh, sure. Read eval print loop. And so it's like dropping down to the command line in a language. So you can, like in Ruby, for example, you just type Ruby on the command line, and you can start interrogating the Ruby interpreter by writing Ruby and getting responses back. So you type in x equals 5, hit return, and the variable x has been set with that value, and then you can start performing calculations or bring in frameworks and start doing network operations, for example, on the command line, all live. You know, it's not saved in a file or anything, but if you're experimenting with features in a given language, then a REPL is a great way to do it because it's quick and it's very easy to use and very straightforward too. And so, you know, because Swift has that capability, Apple leveraged that to make Playgrounds, right? So Playgrounds are like a REPL on steroids because it's got this visualizer for all its responses as well. And in this beautiful documentation format. So, big fan.
Yep. So coming back to the Mac Update Bundle, which is available at deals.macup. That's okay, deals.macupdate.com. Have you guys heard of albums and CDs? You know, back in the day when you used to buy more than one song at a time, you know, an artist would put together a package and they would call it an album. They put some artwork on it.
Yes, I believe they're still using that concept on iTunes these days.
It's true. Well, so I used to have a rule where I had a two-song rule, and I would never buy an album unless there were two songs on it that I liked. And that's only failed me a few times. But so here we've talked about Dash, we've talked about Paw, and now you've just talked about Code Runner. So there's your three hits on this bundle. So run out and get it.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't, I see a lot of bundles like this, you know, and I think to myself, oh, I've already got that one and that one and that one, and the other ones I don't really care about. For example, like, I don't care about Hype, you know, like, I'm never going to use Hype. Mm-hmm. But Delta Walker actually looks kind of interesting because I've got two computers now. That might be useful.
And it's like a differ folder.
Anybody use Flux, this advanced web design tool? Anybody?
No, I've never heard of that one.
I haven't either.
Whenever you say advanced and web design in the same sentence, chill runs down my spine.
So it's like a visual HTML editor. Those have never been.
Yeah. Rapid Weaver. Rapid Weaver, wasn't that one of them?
Yeah, Dreamweaver, that still exists. No, Rapid Weaver is one and Dreamweaver is another. Yep.
Oh, okay.
They all exist. But, you know, actual developers don't use those things.
Yeah, Hype looks kind of cool. It might be, so you know, for a trinkety sort of piece for your website. If you're a little bumblebee fly around on your website or whatever.
Yeah,
but it looks like it has a timeline.
This to me looks like a sort of an HTML5 replacement for Flash.
That's exactly what it is. That's what they were thinking when they built it.
Yeah.
And good for them. And it's a very well-regarded tool.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When it first came out, it was quite a bit of a claim for it.
A lot of hype, right?
A lot of hype,
Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. All righty then. So I guess that's it for the week. So if people want to find you on the interwebs, Aaron, where would they look?
Go to Twitter at Aaron Vey, or check out my website, magpievideo.com, where you can get my app.
And if you love it, leave a comment on
definitely.
iTunes.
Leave a review, please.
Yeah, so hell, go leave a comment.
Yeah, go. I asked you last night. Did you do it yet?
It's okay. It's okay. We'll wait.
Okay. I'm right here.
Go, so hell. We'll wait.
Have you done it yet? Okay.
And Mark, if people want to find you on the interwebs, where would they look?
I'm at markr@smapsoft.com.
All right. And I didn't say it last week, but this week my name is Tim Mitra, and I am TimMitra on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, it-guy.com. And that's it. We'll say goodbye for the week. And Mac is just getting up off the couch. So it's
goodbye, Mac.
All right, folks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fm. There, you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the items we talked about on the show, as well as links to the apps on the App Store. If you like the podcast, please leave a comment on the website, or if you can, please write a review on iTunes. It really helps others find out about the show. You can also follow us on Twitter. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is @mtjc_podcast. If you'd like to support us, you can pledge any amount on patreon.com/mtjc. You can provide as little as $1 a month. Any amount helps. However, you're free to do as you please. Thanks again for listening.
I'm going to ask you too, Mark. Are you going to go to 360 iDev this year?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I didn't buy a ticket.
Yeah, they're still available.
Yeah. So you know, maybe. It's kind of good timing, actually. You know.
Yeah, I'm sort of between things too. So.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun last time. So.
Yeah, and it's like 4 days, right? So it's almost like it's like a mini WWDC in a matter of speaking, right?
Yeah.
You know.
And it's over a weekend, right?
So, it starts on Saturday, goes August 15th to 19th, so it ends on a Wednesday.
It ends on a Wednesday. Okay, yeah, that's not too bad.
It's kind of in the middle of the week there, right? So
yeah,
it's just it's not quite as expensive as WWDC, but it adds up, right?
Sure, it does.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.